Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTDHD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today is World Refugee Day, which is why we are choosing to broadcast this first conversation, which shares some of the experiences of someone doing work with refugees in the war-torn nation of Congo. In part two of today's program, we will hear about the courageous stand which one woman took against the leaders of a radical wing of the Mormon Church, which continued to embrace polygamy, even while the mainline Mormon Church had discontinued it. It was her courageous stand which led to the downfall of the leaders of this radical cult and brought them to justice and ultimately put them behind bars. We'll hear that stirring story in part two of today's program here on WGTD. This is a very timely interview, I must say, because we're going to be talking about the displacement of refugees and some of the life and death decisions that are also involved when we reach out to refugees and when we try to rescue them from what might seem to be certain death, and some of the really, really difficult choices that need to be made in such situations. Such a terrible crisis confronted my morning show guest, Sasha Chanoff, who is co-founder and executive director of a humanitarian organization called Refuge Point, which tries to reach out to the world's refugees and find lasting, sustainable solutions for them. He was a young man when he was dispatched to the nation of Congo, racked with violence, sent there to help facilitate the evacuation of a number of refugees, only to find an already difficult situation even more difficult when he unexpectedly found other refugees that he desperately wanted to somehow rescue, but running the risk of the entire evacuation operation being imperiled. He confronted all kinds of very, very difficult choices, and he recounts that harrowing experience in this book, co-authored by his father, David Chanoff. And the book goes on to explore some of the lessons that can be taken from this really desperate situation and the terrible life and death choices that confronted young Sasha Chanoff. And the result of all that is this book, co-written by father and son, called From Crisis to Calling, Finding Your Moral Center in the Toughest Decisions, published by Barrett Kohler Publishing. And Sasha Chanoff, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. I was a young man then. I hope I'm not too old now, although that was a little while ago.
Right. Actually, let's try to, first of all, set the scene in terms of what brought you to the point of this desperate situation that you confronted in the nation of Congo. At that point in time, what organization were you part of, and what had sort of led you there?
At that time, I was working with the International Organization for Migration. It's an intergovernmental agency that works with the U.S. and other governments to implement migration programs. IOM also works in rescue operations around the world. The U.S. government had contracted us to send small evacuation teams into the Congo to evacuate Tutsis, a tribe of people in the Congo who were being maligned and attacked and massacred at that point. My boss, David Dursick, was the architect of these evacuations, and on his last effort to extract people, the Congolese officials held back 112 survivors of massacres. These people were in a safe, protected compound that had been created by the international community. My boss had to leave them there. He came out, and finally the Congolese government said to the U.S. government, you can come in and get these people. So my boss turned to me in our office in Nairobi, Kenya, where we were based, and handed me a list with 112 names on it and said, Sasha, I'm sending you in on this last rescue mission. The job is to get these 112 people out. Under no circumstances can you include anybody else on the evacuation flight on this list, because if you do, the Congolese officials will most likely stop everybody from going. I've seen that they are just not trustworthy, and so stick to the list, you'll succeed. If you try to include anybody else, you'll fail, and the people you leave behind will most likely lose their lives there. He said he was sending his right-hand woman in with me. Her name was Sheikha Ali, and she had been on every previous mission with him. Sheikha and I flew into the Congo, rented a car and a driver, and went into this safe, protected compound that had armed guards in it, and we found the 112 survivors there. But then someone working in the compound said, you have to go into that tent over there and look at some new people who just came in. And we said, we can't go in. Then Sheikha turned to me and said, Sasha, I'm going into that tent. And then my feet were following her into the tent before I could think. And as we stepped inside, we found that there were 32 widows and orphans in that tent. They looked emaciated and traumatized. The guy who was working in the compound turned to us and whispered, they were in a prison camp, not because they'd been done anything wrong, but simply because they were the wrong people in the wrong place at the wrong time. They were in a prison camp. Their family members had been executed. The survivors here were very close to death, and it was clear that if we didn't take them, they wouldn't survive.
Mm. So that's the heart and the soul of the quandary that you and your coworker faced about what to do, whether or not to try to include these widows and orphans as part of the evacuation process, and if trying to do so might imperil everybody's survival. How old were you at this time?
I was 28 years old. I had graduated from college about 6 years earlier. I'd never done anything like this. I wished I could have called out, you know, to someone who had more experience and said, what do I do? But I trusted my boss. He had told me, don't take anybody else. And he also told me, don't trust. I'm sending my right-hand person with you, but she might try to take people. You can't let her do that. Mm. I'll tell her she can't, but she might not listen to me. So you have to stop her if she tries.
Right. I'm a little bit amazed that someone so young and relatively inexperienced would be entrusted with such a responsibility. Is there just that there was nobody else available, or was there something about you and your own sort of array of skills and characteristics that you were deemed the right man for such an astonishing responsibility?
Yeah, I'm not sure I had any special skills or characteristics. I do think that my boss, David, trusted me, and he knew that Sheikha, my colleague on this rescue mission, knew how to do everything. She was a seasoned person in these situations. So he said, just follow her lead. She knows how to do everything. But I think he sent me because he felt that I would stand up to her if she did try to take other people.
Right.
And so he, you know, while I was the junior person on this mission, he kind of entrusted me with holding to the list.
Hmm. Tell us more about this camp to which you and Sheikha traveled, and the fact that there were more than 112 people there. I mean, more than the 112 who were on this list, the people whose evacuation was approved. You describe a scenario in which it appeared like there were maybe 400 or 500 people actually there. What kind of a camp was this, and how did all these other people find their way there?
So in 1998, when the president of the Congo said on TV that people of the Tutsi tribe are the enemy and need to be hunted down and imprisoned and exterminated, this was in response to events that came about after the Rwandan genocide. Massacres started taking place across the Congo. People went into hiding. And the stories I heard were similar to Holocaust stories. People would go into attics and spend a year hiding in an attic or in a secret compartment in a house. The international community created this safe compound near the capital of Congo. Kinshasa is the capital. And so survivors who were hiding heard about this place. And then when my organization started going into the Congo, they found people who were in hiding. Other people heard about this place and managed to get in there. So it became kind of a magnet for people who had been in hiding to try to get there. The International Committee for the Red Cross, which works in crisis situations, was also on the ground and was getting into prisons where innocent civilians had been taken and were being executed or tortured or brutally treated. And they started, through negotiations, bringing people out of these prisons and into this compound.
Mm.
So the evacuations took place from this compound to evacuation flights to the country of Benin and Cameroon, from where all the survivors were interviewed for the U.S. resettlement program and then permanently relocated to the U.S. But so, yeah.
So describe what you and Sheikha were supposed to be doing there, and in a sense, what an awkward situation it was in terms of what you were supposed to be doing with these 112 people on your list versus all of these other hundreds of people who were there. I mean, describe that scenario of what you were supposed to be doing and in a sense, how tricky and awkward it was to do it.
Oh, it was the scariest and most horrifying situation I've ever been in my life. Sheikha and I drove into this protected compound with these big gates that swung open. It was about a 2-acre compound with 10-foot walls and kind of jagged shards of glass on top of the walls. And someone saw Sheikha, and she had been on previous missions, so many people knew her, and someone shouted her name. And all of a sudden, there was a crowd of people around the car, and they started chanting her name and pushing the car up and down. And I remember my boss, David, telling me that people are going to be so immensely relieved that they're going to be overjoyed. Because when they see you, they'll know there's another evacuation flight. And the people there think they're going to die there. They've already seen many family members die. They are, you know, have barely survived themselves. But the situation felt very scary and out of control to me because there were more people in that compound than we had on our list. And our evacuation flight only had 126 seats. We had 112 people on our list. We were told we could not take any more. And then with a few of us emergency officials, you know, almost all the seats were already taken. So we got in there and immediately I saw that, oh my God, this is a situation where we only have 112 seats and yet there are hundreds of people in here.
And so the others are just as desperate to leave.
The others were as well desperate to leave. You know, the fact was that not everybody in that compound was actually at risk. This evacuation had gotten to be known, so people who actually, some of them looked like they weren't so badly off, were in that compound. And in fact, if you'll recall, in the Rwandan genocide, the killers of the Rwandan genocide were known as genocidaires. They were the extremists who perpetrated the Rwandan genocide, and they, after the Rwandan genocide, had fled into the Congo. And Sheikha pointed out to me in that compound that there were some genocidaires in there. I remember when we were registering people, what we did was we set up a small table on top of a hill and people gathered below and we called people who were on our list up and I took their name and birth date and took a photo of them. And I saw somebody standing down below in the crowd with this kind of hat on and this ratty sports coat and sunglasses, and he didn't look at risk at all. And I said to Sheikha, "Who's that?" And she whispered to me, That's a genocidaire. He's one of the killers of the Rwandan genocide. He's been perpetrating violence here in the Congo. Mm-hmm. You know, it felt like it was this, you know, feeling of revulsion to see somebody who had committed such atrocities. But so not everybody in there was completely at risk, but many people did seem desperate. Somebody grabbed me when we were trying to leave and grabbed my shirt and pulled me close to his face and said, "Sasha," they had learned my name, "Sasha, look at me, look at my face. You know what'll happen to me if you leave me here. You can't leave me here."
Hmm. So you have all of these people desperate to be evacuated, to be rescued, and then you also have sprinkled amongst them people who in a sense are interlopers, perpetrators of terrible crimes, which made you realize that this so-called safe haven was actually not all that safe a place after all. You say at one point, the whole thing was a giant paradox. The Congo regime was slaughtering Tutsis right and left, but at the same time was being forced to help save at least some of them by allowing this protection center to operate. Can you explain the means by which the Congo government was forced to do this, seemingly against their wishes?
Yeah. So there was not a huge amount of media attention in terms of spotlighting the violence that was happening in the Congo. When I heard the stories of survivors, it was shocking how little media attention was there. But the international community came together when the violence started and started putting pressure on the Congolese government, saying, you have to let us evacuate. You have to let us evacuate people here. So the Congolese government acquiesced to that international pressure. So while on the one hand, there were massacres going on in the country and people were being killed, on the other hand, the international spotlight was on this situation. And so the U.S. ambassador at the time, Ambassador Swing, and others had put pressure on the Congolese government to allow these evacuations to happen. Hmm. And so and Congo, of course, was at war at this point, too. There were 8 or 9 countries in the Congo fighting either for or against the Congo to try to access the resources in the Congo. And so it was a very dangerous situation with a lot of complexity.
I think it would also be good for you to explain why the IMO's rescue missions that had been operating were, in a sense, forced to shut down. I mean, it speaks in part to what you were just describing, some of the chaos there, and also some of the corruption that, in a sense, made an orderly evacuation all but impossible.
Yeah. Well, these missions, nobody thought these missions would be successful, I think. It's very unusual for an organization to go into a country at war and evacuate people. That's not the common thing. Commonly, what you see is that refugees flee across an international boundary, and then they are received by the international community and the neighboring country, and they receive protection there. So it's very unusual for this sort of thing to happen. And I think my boss, David, succeeded in managing the first rescue missions against many, many odds. But when on what was to be the last mission, when the Congolese immigration officials held back 112 people without giving any reason for that, he felt that things had finally gotten too complex, too dangerous, and that the Congolese officials were saying one thing but doing another, and so there was no opportunity to continue doing this.
Hmm. We're speaking with Sasha Chanoff, who is the co-author with his father, David Chanoff, of a book called From Crisis to Calling, Finding Your Moral Center in the Toughest Decisions. We're talking about a desperate situation in which he found himself as a relief worker trying to help expedite the evacuation of 112 Tutsi refugees from the nation of Congo, a desperate situation which was made even more desperate by the very real danger that all of it could ultimately sort of come undone, and some of the really terrible decisions which he himself faced in trying to facilitate this very difficult evacuation. One of the things that you write about is how in doing this kind of work, there is, to some extent, a tendency to limit your empathy to each and every person, and of thinking them only as names on a sheet of paper. I mean, thinking of these people in only the most sort of clinical terms, as refugee number 5, refugee number 6, versus human beings with names, with histories, with families, with loved ones. Talk for a moment about that sort of split within yourself in terms of how to think of these people.
Well, a year before this evacuation mission happened, I was in a room listening to a U.S. government and U.N. refugee agency decision about another group of refugees to resettle to the U.S. and whether or not we should resettle a group known as the Sudanese Lost Boys, which were orphans from South Sudan who were in Kakuma Camp in Kenya, or the Somali Bantus, who were a group of Somali refugees in Kenya who had been treated terribly in Somalia and persecuted there. And the conversation was a lot about numbers and about what kind of material or what kind of registration information existed. And I was just so startled listening to this conversation that it was a very clinical conversation by necessity. But the lesson that I drew from that is that it was so strange to feel that in that room, people were making decisions about others' lives. And I think you have to be aware, as you put it, that these are all people with families, with loved ones who are just like you and me. My own family came to the U.S. as refugees 100 years ago, and I think so many of us have that kind of background. And we're fortunate to be in the situations we're in now. So one of the lessons that I took going in with me was the idea that you have to not just think of people as numbers. Today, there are 60 million refugees or people who've been displaced by conflict more than at any point in history. We can't think of them just as numbers. We have to think of them as people who can contribute to society, who are journalists and reporters and lawyers and doctors and teachers and farmers and others. And so that's the lens that we have to take when we approach these situations. So I did have this list of 112 people, but when I came face to face with those widows and orphans, and then when Sheikha started arguing with me and telling me that this was our responsibility, I felt at kind of my core that it was our responsibility. I didn't at first, but she convinced me through our argument. She finally said to me after hours of arguing, "Sasha, we're humanitarians. We're on the ground here now. If we don't do this, these people will be forgotten and they'll die here. This is up to us." And it made me think about who I was, who I wanted to be in the world, and what my core values were. And I realized that I couldn't turn away from these people now that I had seen them. I felt responsible for them.
Right. She posed that question, basically, are we humanitarians or are we not? And you said, that got to me. It crushed every defense I had left.
Yeah.
As you describe this scenario, I think one of the things you say that is especially helpful is in talking about our propensity in such a situation to just sort of think about the facts, think about the numbers. You say you think about the numbers, you think about what's easier to do and what's the most efficient way to do it. And I suspect that here is an instance of something which is applicable, even if someone does not find themselves in as horrific a situation as you did. But we all, for all kinds of reasons, find ourselves gravitating to what is going to be the easiest thing to do and what is the most efficient way to do it. And when you think about it in those terms, it's really kind of chilling, because it's very easy then to realize how our own sense of humanity can be sacrificed and the greater good can be sacrificed for the sake of ease and efficiency.
It's such a great point. I mean, I think it's so easy for all of us to just have our heads down, focused on our lives. We're in school, we're parents, we're working, we're studying. We don't have time necessarily to do things that are out of our comfort zone. It's not easy to make a decision that will take you into a new place or open your eyes to a new situation. But the point that we make in the book is that when you do this, when you open your eyes to something that might be difficult, to a new situation, that can help you understand who you are more deeply. That can help you to connect with your own deepest sense of humanity, and that can change your own life. And of course, people aren't going to face the kind of situation that I face, but we all are going to face decisions, particularly with all the refugees in the world right now and the crises that we're facing as a global community. We'll face decisions that impact others in a significant way. And we can't just look down. We can't just take the easy route. We have to think about what it means for us personally. Because when we make decisions based on our own experiences and our own understanding and values of ourselves, that's when we can transform ourselves and others around us.
Hmm.
And that's what happened to me. I went on to start this organization, Refuge Point, to focus on refugees who are off the radar, who are the most at risk and had nobody there for them.
Hmm. Before we finish, we should give you a chance to kind of spell out some of the basic components that you see that need to be part of what you call moral decision making. And I suppose it's only in retrospect now, as you look back at some of the tough decisions that you ended up making in the Congo, and the way in which, by the way, ultimately you were able to include these 32 widows and orphans with the 112 refugees and got just about everybody out safely. In retrospect, you've sort of taken that apart and sorted out some of the components that are involved in making some of these difficult choices with a strong moral foundation. What are those five components?
Yeah, I think these components are applicable to all of us. We will all face decision points that might test our values and ways. So these five principles, the first one is to be prepared. Know that at some point you will face a decision that impacts others in a significant way. The second point is to open your eyes. You must, when you're prepared, open your eyes to that decision. For me, opening my eyes was actually stepping into that tent. I was lucky that I had this moral guide, Sheikha, who brought me in there, because otherwise I might not have done that. Open your eyes is the second principle. The third one is to confront yourself, because even if you open your eyes to a situation, that might not be enough. For me, I needed Sheikha to argue with me. And as she argued with me, it helped me confront who I was as a person. The fourth one is to know yourself. Once you're arguing with yourself or someone's arguing with you about what to do, then you can understand who you are as a person. What makes you an individual? What makes you unique? And if you tap into that, you'll have a sense of what you should do in that particular situation. But even with all those four principles, it might not be enough. The fifth principle is to take courage, because any decision might carry consequences that are hard, that are negative, might have dangerous or complex implications for our lives. So take courage to do what you feel is the right thing to do. So not all these principles will apply to everybody, but I think that there is a general applicability for people in very difficult situations. And what I found was that I went through this kind of process, and what happened with me was that it led to my life changing. It led to starting an organization that has now reached out to tens of thousands of the most at-risk refugees around the world and gotten them to places where they can rebuild their lives safely.
Explain to our listeners how the second part of this book is put together and the kind of stories that are included in it.
Oh, this was also just as exciting as the first part for me. We interviewed people from the military and healthcare and CEOs of companies to ask them about the moral decision points that they have faced and how facing those helped them to understand their own values and guided their actions and leadership moving forward in their lives. And we use a range of stories from a range of different fields to highlight and articulate that these are universal situations, that these kinds of decision points are not just left to the humanitarian space or to the unique situation I had, but that they're actually not uncommon, and that we all, in any profession, in any walk of life, might face these kinds of situations. So what we hope to do with the second part of the book is to really generalize and universalize these principles and these stories so that we can connect with others, so that people can read this and say, wow, that could be me. I might face a decision like this at some point. I might face my own unique decision, and I have to really try to think of who I am and who I want to be in the world in order to confront that decision.
Right. As one point the book says, the need to grasp hold of who you truly are is a powerhouse of a drive. Once engaged, it is compelling, undeniable, neglected or frustrated only at a person's psychological peril. The deep self has its own dynamic and imposes its own demands. And in a sense, that's what happened with you the moment you realized, yes, I am a humanitarian. I must do this, even though it is an incredibly difficult thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact is that the moral sense, our own understanding of our humanitarian core, is always at war with other things, with our need for acceptance, with our need to follow orders, with many things. The sociologist James Q. Wilson writes that the moral sense is not a strong flame. It is rather a small candle, flickering and sputtering in the strong winds of power and passion, greed and ideology. But brought close to the heart and cupped in one's hands, it dispels the darkness and warms the soul. And I love that quote, because what it says to me is that, yes, we're always going to be at war with many other emotions and many other drives that we have within us, but we overlook our moral core at our own peril, and at the peril of reinforcing a shallower sense of self.
I wonder if you could just say a quick word about the refugee crisis that confronts the world at the moment in such a dramatic fashion. I'm talking about the refugees streaming out of Syria and the very difficult, vexing questions which it raises for all kinds of different countries around the world.
Yes, there are 60 million people today who have been displaced by war and conflict and violent persecution. Among them are about 12 million Syrians. So, of course, that is the area that's getting all the news. But we can't overlook the crises in South Sudan, across Africa, Afghanistan, and other places in the world as well. But what we found right now is we are confronting a new age, a new time, where there are more people displaced than at any point in history, more than even since World War II. And the average amount of time that someone lives as a refugee today is nearing 20 years. So people no longer go home. In Dadaab Camp in Kenya, the largest in the world, there are over 10,000 children whose grandparents arrived there as refugees. And I've been to Dadaab, spent a lot of time there. It's not a place you want to spend time. So we need to find new ways of addressing these crises. We can't just respond with emergency aid, thinking that we'll give somebody a food and a tent and health care until they can go home. Because that emergency aid now in 2014 spent, there was $25 billion spent, and it wasn't nearly enough. So we have to transition our lens of addressing this crisis from an emergency approach to recognizing that refugees will be permanent residents in the countries to which they fled and around the world. We have to recognize also that these are people who bring assets, who contribute to their communities. So we have to find ways for them to become self-reliant so that we can responsibly disengage from aid. And this is what our organization, Refuge Point, focuses on, is identifying those people in the worst situations, permanently relocating them to the U.S., Canada, Australia, and countries around the world, and in addition, looking for self-reliance opportunities for people who fled to a neighboring country so they can stay there and rebuild their lives there.
Hmm. I wanted to finish by saying that the desperate situation you describe in the Congo has some connection to the horrific genocide which occurred earlier in Rwanda. I happen to have a young friend who is doing work now in Rwanda, and she describes the country as beautiful and peaceful and utterly transformed from the horrors that occurred there some years ago. And I was so heartened to hear that, and it was a way of holding on to hope in a world where it seems like there are so many terrible problems mounting by the day. But the story of Rwanda is a story of hope and encouragement.
It's such an important point. Congo as well is a country that's rich in terms of culture, business opportunity, diversity, and incredible people. And we can't just take the soundbite media impressions of these places and think that it's a one-dimensional horror show. That's not the case. I've been to Congo. I've been to Rwanda. These are places where you meet people who are just like you and me. And when you open your eyes to these situations, when you see them kind of and experience them, you know that there's not that much that's different, that people in those places are the same as we are. And I think that's so important to understand so that we don't take away these stereotype impressions of these places.
If people want more information about your organization, Refuge Point, how can they get that information?
Yeah, they can go to www.refugepoint.org, and our organization is there. We're doing what I would say is the most vital work in the world across Africa and now expanding across the world to reach the most at-risk refugees and find solutions for them so they can rebuild their lives safely.
The book is From Crisis to Calling, Finding Your Moral Center in the Toughest Decisions, published by Barrett Kohler, and the author, Sasha Chanoff, along with his father, David Chanoff. Sasha Chanoff, I've been honored to speak with you. Thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your story and about your fascinating book. Thank you and best wishes.
Thank you. This has been such a pleasure. Thanks so much.
In part two of today's program, author Rebecca Musser takes us behind closed doors of a radical wing of the Mormon faith, the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, a cult which continued to practice polygamy even as the practice was banned in the mainline Mormon church. Rebecca Musser, as a teenager, became the 19th wife of 85-year-old Rulon Jeffs, but her own personal nightmare took a darker turn upon the death of Jeffs when leadership of the cult passed to his son, Warren Jeffs, who engaged in widespread abuse, fraud, embezzlement, and more. It was Rebecca Musser's courageous choice to confront Jeffs in a court of law that ultimately put him behind bars. Her book is called The Witness Wore Red, the 19th wife of who brought polygamous cult leaders to justice, published by Grand Central Press. We're spending the next few minutes with Rebecca Musser, the author of this powerful memoir called The Witness Wore Red. Rebecca Musser, you write about such difficult, painful experiences, both in your childhood and then young adulthood, your marriages and so on, and your decision finally to escape this life which you had experienced. What was it like to relive some of these past hurts and pains and traumas in your life in writing this memoir? Was it a cleansing, cathartic experience, or was it a more difficult experience to relive all of this, to retrace these painful steps?
In reality, it was both. I think that for all of us, we all have parts of our lives that are painful, and we would like to think, you know, can we just forget about it and pretend it did not happen? And at the time that I started writing my book, then I had already testified multiple times, and I was accustomed to answering questions. But when it came down to really putting into the emotions of what did that feel like, that unleashed an incredible torrent of a lot of anger, actually, and frustration that I had never addressed, nor did I know how to. So it was a very cleansing process, but it was painful. And, you know, at the end of the day, I wrote The Witness Wore Red not only to be witness to my life, not only about what it was like to be a witness in the courtroom, but also to be a witness to the 1 in 4 women in our nation who are sexually assaulted or abused or oppressed. This is my story, but my story is one in a global problem. And it's time. We can't stop what we don't know is happening. And as painful as it was to be very open about some of these raw, honest things that were very hard to go through and very hard to look at after, I wanted to because it's time. It's time for change, and we can't stop what we don't know is happening.
You grew up in this fundamentalist sect of the Mormon Church, which not only drew heavy lines of demarcation apart from the whole non-Mormon world, the Gentiles, so to speak, but even from mainstream Mormons, there was also this sense that they had fallen away, and only this tiny fundamentalist sect was remaining faithful to the calling or to the work. Can you just say a word about what it felt like to be, in a sense, so isolated in that respect, being told and to some extent at least believing that the rest of the world, including people you knew on some level were good, decent people, were evil? How does one make sense of that, especially when you're a youngster?
You know, even as a young child, I remember thinking, how can this be the only group of people who's going to be saved and everybody else is wicked and everybody else is going to be destroyed by God? And even though I was taught that I was part of this elite group of people, that I had a bigger responsibility to be more obedient, it was hard because I thought, man, that's really mean what separates me from them, except that the family that I grew up in, it was hard to see, and it was a question that weighed on my mind for as long as I can remember. But I never came up with a really good answer to it while I was there.
You were part of a family growing up, which most of your childhood involved two wives, multiple children living under one roof, sequestered families, and then because you moved into a different house at some point, and your families were actually living more together. And it was fascinating to read about the different dynamics of that one house where one family was in the basement, the other was upstairs, everyone with the same father, but two wives, two different sets of children, and then suddenly coexisting within one structure and the ways in which you tried to make sense of that. I was especially fascinated by how you and your siblings would come up with your own means of trying to defend yourselves and defending the younger children from the abuse of older children underneath the household. Can you just talk a moment about some of the ingenious, creative ways in which you and your siblings were trying to make the best of a chaotic and ultimately very difficult situation?
For my siblings and I, because we were the second wife's children, and we were our father's secret from the first early part of my whole life. My father did not make it open that he was a polygamist to his business associates and the outside world. So we were accustomed to laying low and to hiding out. But my father's first wife was not born and raised in the FLDS. She had married her high school sweetheart, who was my father. She had five children, and then they converted to the FLDS. And then, you know, my father marries a woman almost 20 years younger who's beautiful, who's talented, and I can imagine that would have been hard. So in her jealousy, she was suffering, but she made sure that my mother's children suffered tremendously. There was a lot of physical abuse. And we would, my siblings and I, would do things. If she singled out any one of us, I mean, we were beaten until we were bloody many times. And we figured out real quick that if we could distract her or get her looking in the other direction or come chasing after another one of us who was a little bit further away, it would give that other sibling enough time to run. And there was a tremendous amount of tag teaming going on to just dodge the bullet. Speed was our biggest friend, and to be able to buy some time or hide out, because if our mother was gone, and sometimes even when our mother was there, if she got our hands on us, we were in some big trouble, painful trouble.
As an intelligent young child, you to some extent received consolation in school and loved the experience of being educated, except you trace a pattern of the education at the primary school where you went, which was under the control of this sect, the education becoming more and more limited. And you especially tell of a very poignant moment when nearly all of the books were removed from this small school's library. One more symbol that the kind of education you were receiving was becoming much, much more limited. And this was something that caused you a great deal of grief.
It was very hard because I was so fascinated with just, you know, the world and people. I was fascinated with maps and the way that other cultures lived. And we did not watch TV. We weren't supposed to listen to any music from the outside world. I did, you know, play classical violin music. I was gifted with that opportunity to study music. But on the educational side of everything, we were taught every single day that the world was bad and everything that came from the world was evil and bad. And if we enjoyed reading or even their music or anything from them, that was evidence of how evil we were. So I had this constant struggle about, you know, why do I like it? Why am I so curious about it when I'm supposed to be a good priesthood girl and not even ask the questions? And it was a constant tug of war, you know, that I had during my whole entire life growing up there. I did learn, however, to be silent about it because it was dangerous to speak out.
And you do write beautifully about what music represented to you. You call it at one point in the book your only refuge. You ultimately become a teacher at this same school and at some point become the 19th wife of the then 85-year-old Rulon Jeffs, the head of this sect, and 48 other wives followed you. Can you just say a word about why someone like you, who was as outspoken as you were, would have been selected? Do you think it was in some ways to get you under tighter control, or otherwise, why were you sought out and given as one of the wives to the sect founder?
I think, first of all, it's important to realize that even in a closed society like this, there is some hierarchy, and part of it had to do with my bloodlines, that I was, you know, my mother came through a bloodline that was many of my father's or my grandfather's daughters married high-ranking FLDS leaders. So that was part of it. As, you know, to say why I was singled out more so than others, you know, as you said, there was a number of other girls that were singled out. Growing up, I really tried hard to be a good, obedient priesthood girl. I wanted that to be true because that's all that surrounded me. I wanted to be a good student. I wanted to memorize it all. And yet I still couldn't silence that other voice inside of me. Marrying Roland Jeffs was very hard because I was taught my entire life, this is what you live for. This is everything that you have lived for up until this point in time. And if you say no, then your damnation is assured. You are throwing away the greatest blessing you could have been given. So it's a very confusing time because part of me wanted to do the right thing. But if I would have said no, not only did it equal my damnation, but also a tremendous amount of shame on my family.
Right. You write so tellingly about what it's like to live in a sect like this. And I think one of the ways in which we most vividly understand that is when we read of the reaction, first of all, to the events of Waco, Texas, and this sense you were all told we are next and the government will do something even worse to us. And then 9/11 occurs, and there, from the leaders at least of your sect, is rejoicing the idea that this attack on the U.S. government was somehow a positive sign of events moving as they predicted and prophesied. I mean, that really tells us something about the skewed view of the world and of events that the rest of us see very differently. Ultimately, what was it that drove you to escape this sect? I mean, what was it that you saw and realized about the sect that made you realize, I can no longer be part of this?
Well, I think a number of things, but the final straw was when Roland Jeffs died and Warren Jeffs was forcing his young wives to be remarried. During my 7 years of marriage to Roland Jeffs, I saw not a man who was supposed to be God. I saw a very mortal man who had very carnal desires and was not very compassionate in how he pursued those. The sexual violation was the breaking point for me. When he died and Warren was forcing his young wives to be remarried, I could not bring myself to go into another situation where I would be forced to be sexually violated by another man. And so I just decided I didn't know what was in the outside world, this world that I'd been taught to fear, and that I would become so evil and wicked and damned if I left. That was better to me than to stay and be subjected to more violations.
Rebecca Musser. Her book is called The Witness Wore Red, the 19th wife who brought polygamous cult leaders to justice. The book climaxes thrillingly in the courtroom drama which led to the conviction of Warren Jeffs and other leaders of this cult. The book is published by Grand Central Publishing. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Ellen Fitzpatrick, whose fascinating book, The Highest Glass Ceiling, examines in detail three previous attempts by women to run for the U.S. presidency, one of those from the late 19th century, Victoria Woodhull, closer to our own day, Margaret Chase Smith, and Shirley Chisholm, with an epilogue which examines the candidacy of Hillary Clinton. Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for The Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult